Hello and welcome to the second in our podcast series about women in leadership in the design space. And I'm very happy to welcome Caroline and Emma to this one. I feel really fortunate that we managed to get these two in the room together, because both in very senior leadership positions within two very well-known agencies. So yeah, thank you both initially for coming. As a short sort of introduction, I am passionate about this topic because I did a LinkedIn post which came actually from a conversation that I had with Koto, who sort of tasked me with something which I thought was going to be very simple, would be to find an amazing sort of female design director for the team. And actually, it was much more difficult than I initially thought. So I did a post which was kind of summarising some findings that I'd found, and it went really mad, and lots of people were commenting on it. Mostly women were commenting on it, which was just summarising the drop in women in sort of design industry. So that's kind of where this came from. I'm really keen to hear and sort of start some conversations around this topic with Emma and Caroline. But Emma, I'll start with you, currently Global Creative Director of Wolf Olins. I'd love to know who was the first person who made you feel talented.
My dad. Like, the reason that sticks in my mind is he's a typical northerner, so I don't show your emotions very well. Very rarely compliment. And I remember him buying me some pencils and just leaving them in my bedroom with a drawing pad. And that was his way of encouraging me to kind of keep drawing and being creative. So, yeah. And so my dad.
Your dad. And do you think that, because we ask that question to everyone, and it's often a very early kind of teacher in the creative space, or one person was their granddad who was actually a carpenter, but really appreciated someone else being quite creative in the way that they work. Do you think it's really important having that person sort of banging the drum for you when you're younger to sort of inspire you and make you feel talented?
Absolutely. I think everybody's born creative, but I think society, like, weirdly enough, kind of like drums it out of you. And like, I mean, your mum might say when you're like four, oh, you're really good, and put your picture on the fridge. But I think everyone's mum does that. I think you need to, in order to keep kind of pursuing your career or your dream in creativity, you need somebody who champions you, who tells you that you're good at it. Because, yeah. And I often don't think it is schools. I think it does come from family members. I remember at school, like, I was disruptive, I was naughty. I wasn't encouraged or told I was good at drawing, even though I clearly was, because I've got a career in it.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. That's true. And Caroline, I know that we had a bit of a laugh about this question before, but who was the first person that made you feel talented?
My girlfriends at school.
Really?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about that. I think about the kind of the support and the friendship and the strength, power of strength that we had as a group. And I think that's stayed with me. Well, definitely has stayed with me throughout the whole of my life. I'm still friends with them. But I think when you're younger, you're more open to taking on that praise or believing in that praise and understanding it and letting it mold you. I think the older, well, certainly for me, the older I got, I was much more resistant to that. And
yeah.
I think it was up to me to believe in the talent I had. I couldn't really take it on board from other people, but definitely my girlfriends at school, that's where it started.
Yeah, it's so true, actually, isn't it? Being receptive to praise is like quite a, you know, because you're used to it when you're younger, aren't you? I think that you're more resilient, less, I guess, you're open to people sort of bigging you up. And I think as an adult, I certainly get more embarrassed about it than I would be like, wow, this is great. But you know, that's really true.
You also learn to give it as well.
Yeah.
I think there's something really empowering about being able to give praise in the best way, and I think you do that when you're younger, and then you have to learn better tactics of it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And sort of to move on to, you know, this the sort of women in leadership, mostly in kind of the design space, as leaders yourselves, and I'll ask Caroline you this question first, but can anyone be a leader?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
Because I don't think leadership is about power. or about status or about scale. And the more people that you have around you makes you a bigger leader. Mm-hmm. I think it can happen in the smallest, most intimate moments. And I think it comes with... you have to have a level of belief in yourself. You have to be risk adverse, and mm-hmm. you have to believe in the power of a group as well. But I think anyone can be a leader. You need people around you to believe in your leadership, for sure. But it can happen in many different scenarios, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and Emma, what are your thoughts on that?
Slightly different. I think leadership can come from anywhere, in that despite your background, your gender, your race, that should affect your ability to be a leader. But I think, can anyone be a leader? I think if you're passionate... being passionate is infectious and therefore inspiring. And I think if you've got that quality, then yeah, you absolutely can be a leader. Yeah. But I don't know if everybody does have that quality.
Mm. Or want it, maybe.
Or want that quality.
And it shouldn't be forced on people.
As well,
I think, yeah, it has to be a natural desire.
Yeah, for sure. I think people will say, oh, it needs to be, you need to be like really good at your job, or you need to be this, that. That doesn't matter if people are not inspired by you and people don't believe in your passion and your vision.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that we spoke about this before, Emma, but in terms of you both being in leadership positions, have you had any female mentors or kind of people who you've aspired to look towards who have been women?
Early on in my career, no. Like I remember actively looking for it, seeking and feeling like I needed to have a female mentor. And that wasn't because nobody wanted to mentor me, to make the straight. It's just because there wasn't anybody.
Yeah.
But later in my career, there's definitely females who support and champion me. They're not so much leaders, so I'd call out Lou Jordan and Sarah Ashman, the CEO of Wolf Hollins. They're definitely champions for women. But whether I would call them mentors or look at them for mentorship, no. I've honestly struggled throughout my career. Even now, I kind of seek that as a leader. Mm. I'm still seeking that as well.
Yeah, and Caroline, have you had any sort of mentors?
Not in a formal manner, but definitely I have throughout my career. I can think of at different points and different places. I used to work in advertising, and there was definitely some kick-ass women there that I would watch, and how they operated in the, you know, in meetings, and how they ran accounts, and how they held themselves accountable. And yeah, I definitely learned from some amazing women, but there was never, it was never really anything, I mean, I'm old, but there's never really anything, any at that time, it wasn't a, you know, mentorship wasn't something that was in a formal manner. You just had to kind of grab it where you saw it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so brilliant now, that it is something that is so high on the agenda. Mm. And and you can understand that mentoring can come from many different places as well.
Yeah. And obviously you started off your career within the advertising space, now co-founder of Koto, which is a, you know, well-known branding agency. What are the differences between, in your experience, between women in the advertising space, or the quantity, and within the branding space?
Gracious. I would say there was probably more women in advertising. I think there was a level of fight and grit, and there was a hardness to them. Mm. And that might have been also the time when I was in advertising and the kind of status quo that was going on there. And it's probably changed a lot now. It's been many years since I've been in that world. But I think there's much more of a openness and a softness in design, which I think we have to, we have to harness, I think, now.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And I think that, in terms of your progression and your journey towards being a leader, what sort of challenges have you faced, Emma, sort of moving from, you know, a designer into a design director, into more of a creative director, and now, you know, global creative director? Has that felt a challenge? Have you felt like an unfair...
yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to call it out. There's double standards. in our industry. Like, females are measured differently and are held to a higher standard than our male counterparts. Behavior that men are praised for as being passionate or creative, or, you know, it's just one of the guys. Women are labeled aggressive, defensive, emotional. I've actually had those labels. I've been labeled those things myself. So absolutely, yeah, the double standards. And they start really on. They start when you're a designer and they continue all the way up to leadership.
Mm. And do you I don't really know. I don't think anyone knows necessarily the reason for that. Maybe because, you know, people aren't, you know, looking out for each other. But when we spoke before, you experienced that actually the opinion of a, you know, a competitive or motivated, you know, you felt that actually people don't receive that in the same way that they would as a male at your level. Mm-hmm. Can you describe kind of that? What's happened in that way?
Because you're viewed for a male lens, and there's an expectation that's set against you that is only skewed towards a man. So, for instance, I've got a strong point of view. I'm going to defend my work. I'm going to defend my team. That's aggressive. A man does the same thing. Oh, he's just passionate. He really cares about his job. He's just kind of deep, coming in from deep within. There are examples. That they're only, like, one of the few examples.
Yeah. And have you found yourself having to, like, over-masculine the way that you defend work?
Yeah, to a point, yeah. If I'm being honest, I feel like throughout my career I've had to become something that I potentially am naturally not. Mm-hmm. I've had to become more opinionated. I've had to become more assertive, because it's those qualities. And I'm not saying that everyone needs to be like bossy and aggressive or anything. I'm actually saying the opposite. But in order, personally for me, in order to have succeeded, I've had to adopt some of the male qualities and some of the male behaviors, and having adopted them has made me realize actually adopting them is not necessarily a good thing, because, you know, I'm not viewed in the same light. It's actually seen as a negative.
Absolutely. And I think coming from more of a managerial kind of lens, Caroline, have you felt the same way?
Yeah, for sure. I'd say predominantly earlier in my career, all creative directors were male. And being a client servicer and being on much more on that side, I had to learn very quickly how to get my way and use a level of smarts and manipulation, let's just say, and understand when to sit back from a situation and then when to step in. And I learned that really quickly, and it was successful. And not at any point did I ever believe that it was there was some power struggle going on. It was just about understanding the dynamics that were happening in any given situation, and understanding how I was going to get around that.
Yeah.
And ultimately, for the better solution.
Absolutely. I think your current situation is quite unique, because obviously you're one of three founders, two are male, and I know I've spoken to them both about how much they appreciate and love having you around and how the business wouldn't run without you. Do you feel quite lucky to have the support of two males who are in that way? Like,
incredibly.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
I would say this, wouldn't I? But we do make an amazing team. We've got all the, you know, from a skill set point of view, we've got all of our own pieces covered. But also just from the dynamic of the male and gender, the female-male split, as it were, we're very open and kind with each other, and we make sure that we listen to all of our views, and it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, I was listening to a podcast that Ollie did with Sally Oldfield. I don't know if either of you guys know Sally. But she was saying that there's a real problem and an issue with men utilizing women's personality types to do jobs that they don't want to do.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, that's a controversial thing to say. But I was like, actually, there might be some truth in that, saying that I'm not good at this because this is more in your wheelhouse. But actually, maybe, you know, do you think that's got any truth to it?
Yes, if I think about it. If I think this is a kind of fairly generic observation, but when you look at the more service side of of Koto. You know, majority of client service and finance are women. Mm. And I think that's what we're trying to break, yeah, is to ensure that women in design feel that they can continue throughout their career all the way to the very top,
yeah,
where it feels it's a much natural place for women to be in client service.
Yeah.
So we make a very concerted effort of trying to, you know, blend those genders in those roles.
Yeah.
But as a client service background, I absolutely ensure that client service, regardless of gender, has a very big seat at the table at any, yeah, at any point. We're very collaborative and joined up teams across all the teams.
Yeah.
And that's really important.
Absolutely. So in terms of like why we're here, really, the theme of that post which gained so much attention was, I think, that there was 60% of women who end up, of people who enter the design community or creative community, are women. Mm. And then only 23% now, which has been recorded, is sort of female in leadership. It was down, it was like 13% a few years ago. So obviously the rate is increasing. However, the numbers are still much lower and not 50-50. Why do you think there are less women in leadership roles in the creative space? Emma, I'll fire that one at you.
Oh my God, where do I start? And how long have you got? One of the main points is what I said earlier is the double standards. But I think there's so many reasons to add to this. I mean, the biggest is the environment. And companies are too focused on, oh, we need to tick a box, we need to get more females, rather than address the reason why there's not any females and why those females aren't staying. And it's the environment, the conditions that they're having to work in. Mm-hmm. So I'll use a couple of examples. You know, if you're a female, it's lonely. It's really, really bloody lonely when there's nobody like you at the top. There's nobody to talk to. There is lack of mentorship within the within the industry. There's lack of support for new mothers, so people leaving the industry and then coming back after taking a year out. You know, and that affects you physically and it affects you mentally. And then there's these labels that are attached to older creatives because they've had a baby, like baby brain. Mm. Isn't it interesting that like a man has a kid and suddenly he's seen as more mature and he progresses more? A woman seen as somehow it's a weakness. Mm. Or, you know, got baby brain. And then there's the menopause, which, you know, we've talked about this, Caroline. It's this kind of dirty, awkward subject that nobody wants to address, but it needs addressing. Mm. And again, people need to be aware of what happens to a woman when they're at that level leadership. So I think it absolutely is the environment and the conditions that's why people don't stay.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that I speak to, so because I think that the three points that you're talking about, the start of your career, the middle, probably when you're deciding to have children, and then the end, they're three quite defining moments in your career as a woman to start, you know, put your stamp on the industry. And then, you know, if you're coming back after having children, you're probably going to want to go into some kind of leadership role because that's the level that you're at. You don't want to take a step backwards. But then, you know, there seems to be a real lack of support in coaching someone back to that point, or allowing them the freedom and flexibility to... Do you think there's anything that agencies can do to enable someone to come back after sort of maternity leave? Caroline, do you want to...
Yes, for sure. I think, but I think it should start earlier than that. I think it's a very natural thing that a woman and a man, but a woman will get to a certain age and start thinking about family. And the next thought is, well, what about my job? And before they've even become pregnant, it's already on their mind to go, do I stay here? Do I go somewhere else? What's going to happen? And the fear starts to set in and the concern and... the kind of knock on the confidence. So I think it needs to start at that point, and our language and our support needs to already be in place. And it's much more than just having an amazing maternity package. It's about how we talk about it, how we frame what that maternity package looks like, and how actually, even at the point of getting pregnant, we're already supporting you. Mm. You know, hormones are an amazing thing, and when you're getting pregnant and you're absolutely scared about what that future holds and excited, you need to be helping women through that and taking them on that journey and ensuring that you're giving them the reassurance that not just you're going to support them during that time they're off, and of course their job is open, but actually what does that look like? And then when they do come back, it isn't just a case of going, well, are you coming back on this date or this date, and are you working full time or not? You don't know. You don't know how you're going to feel, and so it's allowing them to be in charge of that conversation as well and have the confidence that they can be feel empowered by it.
For sure. And yesterday, Caroline, you said something which kind of, well, definitely shocks me about returning, you know, being in a leadership role as a woman. You feel fortunate to have that role. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I have this theory that there's a ton of women out there who just feel damn lucky that they've got a job. And that's not doing them a disservice. I think it's just the case of going, I feel solid and supported and grounded in this job. I'm lucky. Let's stay here. And I think that's already the mindset that happened. That so when they then think about returning or having a promotion or even moving jobs, that's just too much of a big risk. You know, why would they want to do that? And so what that then can start to do is hinder their own career progression.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, we all know that sometimes moving jobs and roles is part, we definitely know it's part of growth. You know, you can have a whole new sense of being by being in a different role or a different place. You also get promotion and earn more money, which again, you know, it's an important part. Earning more money and having all of that gives you bigger choices and allows you to have childcare. You know, all of these things are so important.
Absolutely.
And if you feel you don't have those opportunities and you feel lucky that you are where you are, you won't even be looking at those doors, let alone opening them.
Absolutely. And Emma, do you feel like you've had to at one point make a choice between your career or your family? Do you think that?
Oh my god, all the time. As you were just speaking then, Caroline, just surface so many like emotions. Like I remember falling pregnant. I have one daughter, and I remember falling pregnant with her, and instead of feeling happy and excited, I was filled with terror. The thought I just started my job and the thought of like telling my employee 6 months in that I needed time out, to the point I took 3 months maternity instead of like 6 or 9. Body hasn't healed, my mind hasn't healed, because I was so paranoid I was going to lose my position.
I mean, it's that I, again, off the back of this sort of topic and having conversations, it's a real choice. And I think then actually you get a, you know, there's obviously a time limit to actually having children, and then that becomes stressful. And you know that I think that having to choose between your career or your family is men don't have to deal with that really, do they?
Sorry, I was just going to say that a word you use there, which is so apt, is choice. And I think that's what we need to give all of our employees, but women especially, is choice, knowing that it is their choice, knowing that they are empowered by that, knowing that, you know, predominantly men get absolutely awful paternity leave, so women don't have a choice. They are off for as long as possible with their amazing maternity package. You know, understanding that actually society is dictating to them and language is dictating to them that they are the ones that have to be the ones stay at home, have to be ones that have to work out what childcare looks like, rushing home to collect the child from nursery. I think all of that, opening up all of that language and choice for men and women is really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just on that as well, I think part of it isn't choice as well, because women, I don't know about you, Caroline, but I, same career as my husband, same job, same time in the industry, same degree, same university, yet for my entire career I earned 20 grand less than him. So it's a lot of the choice is taken away from you because you earn less money, therefore you have to be the one to have the career sacrifice. You have to be the one that takes longer out of your job because you need the higher earner in work. So even if there
that
was a choice to be able to share that maternity, often the choice isn't there because of the salaries are not level.
Yeah. You can imagine my answer to that. That just literally, yeah, makes me rage. Mm. And it will come as no surprise that that doesn't occur at Koto.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's like, you know, that moment should be filled with positivity, yeah. Right? When you find out you're having a child, and that's something that a lot of people have planned and wanted for years. To think that that's filled with kind of terror or stress or anxiety, you know, we should be welcoming that conversation as employers, saying, you know, that's amazing, we'll support you through this. And I think that the narrative or the opinion is that you've got to hide it for as long as you can. I'm petrified, I can't, you know, what if I get sacked, you know, which is terrifying, isn't it, really?
Well, get to a senior level. Like, I had my daughter later in my career because I was hoping that fear would go because I was a director. Mm. You know, I would have a bit more control. And, you know, just to be fair, Wolf Volumes have been absolutely fantastic throughout. But, you know, that fear was still there because the industry puts it on you that if you're going to take time out, then your career is going to suffer for it.
There's something also interesting that happens. It's not just, I don't think it's just about the environment you're in. It's also the person. You know, and I've spoken to someone very recently about this, who she is super senior, she's a director, she's a leader, and she wants to be a mother, and she knows that all the support is there in her employment. But she is very ambitious, and inside her, she's like, how is it going to affect me by taking extended time off? Am I going to lose this ambition? You know, what does that look like? So you also have to kind of deal with it on an individual basis as well, and understand that it's not just the ask of the employee, it's also the employee that needs to be listened to.
100%, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I've got siblings who have gone through this process, and it does seem that my brothers have had an easier time than my sisters with this, which is kind of, you know, is there a way that we can... And I think that something that I said on the last podcast that I'd be keen to hear your thoughts on, so my mum worked in the healthcare industry for a long time. She worked in the NHS, and when someone was going off on maternity leave, what they would do is they would get sort of freelance cover, essentially, to support that person. And then when they would come back, they would almost stagger so that someone's contract would extend by the amount of months, and, you know, someone could work a contract which would match the school holidays, for example. I think that's an amazing idea. And I don't know why in the creative space we haven't done something like that. You know, why haven't we given someone a contract which is 10 months long, which is recurring every year, and actually then it's linked to the school holidays?
Don't get me started why employment and school don't tally up. I mean, it's just my biggest pet hate that companies don't offer enough holiday to cover school. Yeah, I think it's an amazing idea. Like, Wolf do something similar in that they stagger your journey back, so you don't come back 5 days a week, because that would be a massive shock to the system, where mm-hmm. you come back free or 4 days, and you have those, I think we call them like keeping days or check-in days, where you can come back to work while you're maternity. But I don't know of any company that offers like a freelance cover for you, which, yeah, I don't have an answer for that, but I think it's an amazing idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just something that I thought, and I was like, wow, actually, that could be a really good thing to sort of... Because the industry is so rife with freelancers. You know, agencies are often scaling up when the new client is one. Or I know, you know, it might be more expenditure to actually cover that off, but I don't know. What do you think, Caroline?
You can build in that expenditure. I don't see that as the obstacle. I guess the biggest piece is just, you know, within a creative environment, and actually so much of it, the creativity is born from that individual or the strategic ideas or what have you, that becomes the challenge, and understanding how you can ultimately craft a beautiful synergy between ultimately two people doing that. It's not impossible. Yeah. It's something that should definitely be looked at. I mean, once we will always do a faded, no, that's not the right word, a kind of a gentle return back, and always make sure that there is support, so that person's not thinking, great, I've now got to do 5 days work in 3 days.
Yeah.
But yes, but for, as a long-term solution, that would be fascinating to look at how that would work.
Absolutely. So in terms of, like, we've spoken about sort of pregnancy and that, the impact on that. If we're talking about later on in people's career, obviously we spoke yesterday about the menopause. That is something that is not talked about in a leadership team, I would say, often. And I don't think men generally feel massively comfortable talking about that for some reason. But obviously it's a big impact. What do you think we can do to raise that conversation more? And also, what can we do to enable that process to be easier for women going through menopause?
It's a really good question. I think the true impact of going through the menopause can only truly be felt once you've gone through it. sounds so lame. But, you know, you can read as many books and you have a really clear idea of the potential symptoms and impact that it'll have on you personally and professionally. But once someone has, I think it's at that point that person becomes that spokesperson and that advocate.
Yeah.
To start to tell stories and create a narrative around it that is really meaningful. Mm. Because it becomes then much more authentic, and you can then talk to the people around you in a way that you can demonstrate actually what happened. I have the fortune of having gone through the menopause, so it gets talked about quite a lot at COTO. I am very comfortable to talk about it. And you are absolutely right. You can see the slight nervousness that happens. It only happened a couple of times. Everyone's very comfortable about it now. No, I'm being glib, but it is really, really important. Mm. And it just, you know, destigmatize it, you know, make everybody realize that actually it's going to happen to half the population.
Yeah,
that's a guarantee.
But I think this always comes back to this. You have to have someone to see it to believe it. There has to be someone somewhere where you think, oh, that could be me, or this, you know, is me. And then therefore it means that there needs to be more women in senior levels within agencies to be able to talk about stuff and their experience.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's so much assumption gets made when you're looking around the people that you work with. You kind of go, oh, they're feeling that, or they've made that choice because. I think whatever state of life stage anybody is in, if they go through a particular thing which actually then could be used to impact the people around them, I think they should become a spokesperson. We've only just started having women go on maternity leave. I mean, we're a fairly young business, and so it's starting to happen. Mm. And we have a couple that are due soon as well. But I think once that person returns, I think we encourage them to talk about it, encourage them to talk about the experience, not just from a COTO point of view, but from a personal point of view. And then what they're then doing is hopefully, you know, the younger girls are kind of feeling not so fearful of it, or feeling that they can put themselves in those shoes as well. So whatever the experience is, I think we just have to keep talking, keep communicating, not feel that it's just a personal thing that's happening and why would I talk about it at work. Mm. But, you know, allow them the space to feel comfortable that they can.
Yeah. And Emma, do you find yourself sort of looking outwardly in your team and thinking, I need to give that person a bit more love? Maybe that person is a girl or a guy. Mm. Do you think you're more sympathetic with looking out for people who are struggling a bit than necessarily like a male counterpart?
In all honesty, yeah. And I think it's because there are fewer women, and I know the struggles that they're going through. I've witnessed them day to day, and, you know, I love a lot of them, the male counterparts that I work with, but I think they're oblivious to some of the ways in which they behave and some of the ways in which they can make females feel. And I pick up on how they're feeling because I can see it in their face. I've been in their situation. So, yeah, I think I absolutely am more sympathetic and do make a point of being a mentor and a support for these individuals, more for the guys as well, if they need it as well. But, you know, from experience, it tends not to be the guys who need it. It's the females. And also, I'm a big believer that you pass the love down. So I wish I had that support when I was younger. I was so desperate for it, which is probably why I'm slightly masculine now, because I was looking at the guys. But I believe that if I pass that love and that mentoring and that help and support, then the women, you know, below me would start to pass it on as they come up through the ranks.
Yeah. And what advice could you give maybe someone who is like a design director or a new creative director who's male or female, in how to like look out for that, or how to notice people who are kind of, because as we say, there's definitely a drop in the level of women who continue their career into leadership roles. But is there anything, is there more that we can be doing as, you know, leaders in the space?
Well, I've already mentioned like the environment bit, but it's just check in on the younger individuals, and that's guys or kind of girls, to check in, see how they're feeling, you know, make sure that they've got that support, people to talk to. That, and it's one thing you checking in, but it's another thing that them feeling that they can talk to leadership as well. Like, too often I hear in companies that there's this divide between leadership and below, so it's kind of breaking down those barriers for those youngsters as well.
And I think that obviously the design space is kind of, you know, if you could stereotype a designer, it's someone who's maybe a little bit more introverted, someone who doesn't, sits behind a screen, you know, all of that sort of stuff. Don't think that's necessarily true. But in terms of like getting that, it's not always the loudest person in the room who's going to be the brightest or the best. And I think that often a confidence issue is what, you know, Caroline, you've spoken about this previously. It does appear that girls or women in design at sort of more of a junior level have far less confidence than the men, who sometimes aren't even as good. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, I mean, this may sound like a generalisation, but I think there's an awful lot of truth in it, that women are less confident than men. I don't know why. It's either they think they are unconfident, so they behave as if they are unconfident, or they see their counterparts that are male who come across as super confident and they don't feel they can match up to that, so they slightly hold themselves back. I mean, that's definitely has been it's a true thing for me throughout my career, and I would say confidence is only really come about in the later years of my career. I mean, confidence is a funny thing. I mean, it means so much. It affects people in different ways and means something different for different people. But I think if we look at it through that slightly narrow lens, when we look at juniors and middleweights, etc., going through their career, I think we can then understand how we nurture and promote women versus men. I think there needs to be more understanding and nurturing that happens possibly with women, and giving them more self-belief and helping them understand what it feels like to be promoted and how they can rise to that next level. I mean, there's a thing that we have realized when we've been interviewing. Again, this may sound a slight generalisation, but, guys will come into an interview and go, I'm a senior right now and I'm absolutely smashing it and I want to come here and I want to be a design director. And that's fascinating and it's empowering, and you're like, wow, this guy is going to just come in here and do amazing work. And then a female may come in and go, I'm a senior right now, I'm doing really well, and I know I want to be a design director. I really hope that I can prove that to you, and you will promote me. And there's a language that happens there, and you trust what they're saying, and so you take that at face value. But actually, if you can let those women understand what it feels like to already be in that new position, you can get them promoted much quicker.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's so true. Well, what do you think about that, Emma?
I completely agree. I don't think that lack of confidence goes away either. You just learn to mask it more. You know, it's still, you know, intimidating going to a room you know, you're with a load of men, you're the only female, you're then suddenly aware that you're the only female in the room. You learn to hide it.
Yeah. I think, like, but speaking from my personal experience, obviously navigating sort of helping people through interview processes and talking to people about roles, I often find myself having to do like a pep talk with girls before interviews, saying this is so right for you, you're great, you know, this is exactly what, you know, you deserve this opportunity, you know that you can choose from this selection of agencies, blah 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 blah, you know, and really having to G someone up before that to build their confidence never happens. It rarely happens with men. Often I'm having to say, maybe dial yourself that, like, you just need to just check yourself a little bit here, because I don't think you're quite, you know, punching at this level, having wild salary aspirations, you know. and it really is very rare with women.
I wonder as well if it's part of that, the lad culture, going down the pub, going to the football. You know, it's well known in our industry that everyone, all the like, companies play football with each other. So I'm not surprised if you're going down the pub or you're playing football and your mate's going, yeah, you're fucking good, yeah, you're great, mate. The girls are not, but that's a male team. Yeah. The girls are not there. And since there's so few of us, you very rarely have got someone. You've probably got your best mate who's not in our industry, maybe doesn't understand kind of what you're dealing with. So, yeah, there's nobody fighting your corner. And to be honest, when you're down the pub, it's often, you know, if you're playing football, you're playing football with the DDs, you're playing football with the CDs. So you're kind of within this closed circle, like, as a girl, you're just not part of, because you're not invited in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's like, it's an interesting cultural dilemma that I think that we've all experienced in our own individual ways, in kind of, but it's the same. It's that kind of confidence, or that, you know, overconfidence in some, you know, situations with men. In terms of, like, because obviously we spoke about kind of entering the industry and sort of confidence. That's probably where that confidence is built, right at the start, right? Where you maybe you see someone step out of line and protect you or back you, you know. Do you think we're giving young female creatives enough opportunity to build that confidence? I don't know where that could come from.
No, I don't think we are. And I don't think it's because we don't want to or we don't believe in it. I just think we need to be much more conscious about it.
Mm.
And I think it can't just be the job of women to solve it either. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, mentorship within a female space is incredibly important, but also, you know, having a man champion it and talk about it has to be equally important.
Yeah.
And I believe it is. We have to break down so much unconscious bias. We have to break down a huge amount of learnt language around it. You know, I've had so much thrown at me over the time. Things that just, you know, someone else has said, so they're saying it as well, and you're like, really? And so we just have to make sure that, we cut all of that out, and I think there will be, it'll gently change as well.
I also think the qualities that that females bring, and the, you know, especially some of the younger females as well, need to be championed as well.
Absolutely.
You talk about, like, all the little hothead lads that come in the industry. You know, most of the time it's great. You have got that talent and you can back it up. Women also have that talent, and they also tend to be a bit more empathetic. They tend to be a bit more inclusive, but that's not seen as something that you should champion. Everybody should have that, male or female. It's just that it tends to come out more in the females.
Mm.
That's not championed enough in the workplace as well. Those are seen as just, you know, soft qualities.
Yeah.
So I think it's champion those individual qualities that women bring.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. I think Louise on the last podcast was saying that she's got a female counterpart who is brilliant at bringing very young creatives, no matter gender, you know, whatever, onto very client-facing calls and projects, because it really builds that level of confidence where they're like, wow, I'm getting brought on, you know, and I'm here because I deserve to be. And actually, I think we should probably be doing more of that. You know, that's a huge part.
Instead of bringing a female in because she's ticking the box because they need a female.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think that there is some, as simple as that is, you know, even bringing someone to, I don't know, in an environment that you just shouldn't really belong, bring a junior into, and actually valuing their opinion, mm. no matter male, female, you know, whatever, I think that would really help build everyone's confidence, and maybe not always prioritising the loudest, best presenter, actually allowing someone who's maybe a little bit more introverted into that environment, I think could be quite interesting to do.
I totally agree. I think, again, it's just, you know, we have to be conscious that prior to every meeting or interaction or setting up a project or whatever it is where we're bringing people together, what's the right dynamic, what's the right fit, who's been exposed to what who's going to benefit from what, and understanding that it isn't just from the employer or employee rather perspective, but also from your clients. You know, they're also going through their own journey, and there are males, male and females that are sitting there, you know, allowing them to see people around the table that they can can be inspired by, but they can also be mirrored. And understanding what that does, it's, you know, we're definitely talking about this as a, and rightfully so, within the creative industry, but actually it's also who we work with.
Absolutely.
I also think we need to be real with the youngsters coming in, especially the females. I wish somebody had told me when I started, you're going to have to work harder. It is going to be harder than it is for the guys, because there's less females and you will be judged and you will be looked at and there will be different expectations. And I think just making it's shit and I wish it wasn't like that, but it is the reality at the moment, and hopefully things are changing. The path looks like it is changing.
Yeah.
But I think just being like real, I was speaking to one of our designers recently about this, who was so frustrated by the way that she feels and is treated, and the advice I gave her was just accept it. And I think when you accept it, it doesn't make it better, but it means that you can stop fighting it and you can just concentrate on what you need to do. But like fighting it,
that's a really good point.
It doesn't help, it won't go away, it doesn't change things if you fight it. So accept and just push through.
Yeah, accept it and lean into it.
Yeah.
And actually then harness what that is for your own, put yourself into it. You know, it's, I don't think we'll ever find a solution that fits for all. So it's up to the individual to lean into the issue as well. And also, you know, make sure that every single female, whatever discipline and whatever level, feels that they can be part of that gender setting and feels that they can have a voice. And that we can do it as a collective as well. I mean, it definitely is the job of us as female leaders, for sure.
Yeah.
We have to set the standard. We have to be putting the legwork in, keeping it on the agenda 100%.
Yeah.
But we need everybody else around us pushing in as well.
Well, absolutely. I think it's obviously very important for women in leadership to be talking about this, but it's equally important for men in leadership to be talking about this stuff as well. And I think that maybe by setting an example is kind of where the needle is going to really be pushed, you know, because actually if I'm a junior male designer seeing my founder or ECD championing something that I didn't realize was relevant, I think suddenly my opinion is going to change. I think that conversation needs to be happening more often. In terms of like, I'm always curious to find out sort of slight horror stories. Do you guys have any horror stories, like a part that you are willing to share?
I don't know if it's an actual horror story, but it's quite funny. There's very early on in when we started Koto, obviously we did an awful lot of pitching and creds and all of that stuff. And there was one particular one when myself and James had presented all our creds, talked through the challenges, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it got to the point where it's down to negotiating the actual fee and the proposal and the approach and all of that. And James couldn't attend that meeting, and it was just me with the founder of the client. And he absolutely battled me. It was like a gender fight going on, and his language and his body language And he was ultimately trying to get a bargain. Mm. And I didn't budge. And I obviously had a very genuine answer for absolutely everything that he was trying to pull apart. Anyway, it got to the end, and he agreed on everything. And he was like, I've thoroughly enjoyed this meeting, and I have to let James know what a good job that you have done. I'm sure God. He would be proud of you. So I added another zero onto that proposal.
Yeah, not a great one. I mean, that would light the fire in anyone's belly, really, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's just funny, isn't it? Like, yeah, anyway, Emma, have you got any sort of...
I'm having to, like, watch myself here.
I know,
but... I've got so many, but I think the one that sticks out the most is really early on in my career. I'd only been in the industry a couple of years, went to work for a very well-known company, and being told by my CD that I was employed because of the way I looked, not my talent. And I remember everything that I'd worked for at that time, it just came crashing down, to have my CD in front of, like, other men, other people in the team tell me that. And that just took any credibility away from me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's not good.
I mean, that's something else that I think this is for another time. But the inappropriate, basically sexual harassment that females have to deal with within our industry, it's just, it's a whole nother podcast.
Mm, yeah.
But it's just not acceptable. And I don't know if it still goes on, but it definitely plagued me for a lot of my career. And a lot of the females that I've spoken to have experienced it.
Yeah, I think that is a really pressing, because it's undermining someone's value to be there in the same room, right? If you're then marginalising someone sexually, I think that's... But I hear less of that. I think it's sort of spoken about...
I think the industry's got better.
Yeah, I think it's been spoken about, like, the Mad Max kind of, you know, environment of that sort of stuff. I think it's getting better. But I still do think that even the underhand, slightly jokey things, I think should get called out probably more often. What do you guys think about that?
I agree.
Yeah.
For sure. We've got a very strong culture at Koto, and we're very... there's a lot of humour, but there's a lot of kindness. I think that we're very comfortable with taking the mickey out of each other. And yes, of course, it can slightly overstep the line at times, but everyone is very comfortable about picking that back up and making sure and just checking in. But yeah, I mean, that's something I think comes when you feel safe and supported, and that's definitely a culture that we've nurtured at Koto.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we always get it right.
Yeah.
No, I completely agree. I mean, thankfully, we don't have, not that I'm aware of, any, like, sexual predators at all. I'm absolutely positive that we don't. But yeah, I think we're good at calling out that behaviour. And I think you're right. Like, the industry has shifted, and I think the younger generation coming up, you know, their mums are empowering them, their sisters are empowering them, their girlfriends, their friends. So that, I think, that mentality and that behaviour is dying out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that there was this brilliant ad that I, again, referenced in the last podcast, but it was quite recent, where there was kind of this sexual harassment thing happening in the street, and then no one said anything, and the girl gets into the taxi and she's mortified, and then it kind of rewinds, and one of the guy's mates, like, don't do that, like, don't speak to her like that, and it changes the whole kind of narrative of what's going on. And I think that we're getting better at that, calling each other out. I think guys are definitely getting better at calling their friends out, or other people in the studio out, or at that part of the process, which is great. That is definite progression. But again, I do think that comments that your creative director made, they don't belong anywhere near the, well, anywhere, let alone within the work environment. Thank you for that discussion. I think you raised some amazing points. I think that both of you had some really interesting kind of views, and I think that we could probably sit here for another hour talking about this stuff. But it does lead me on to the final section, which we discussed yesterday, which is kind of bringing something that you dislike or hate about the world I gave my examples yesterday of melon, which I've spoken about pretty much on every podcast that I run. Who wants to kick us off with their elephant in the room, elephant vomit kind of thing? Anyone want to go?
I don't mind going first.
You go first.
It's like really petty, but I absolutely hate people eating with their mouths open.
Yeah.
Like hate it. Like, yeah. And I hate it because you can control it. It's an easy thing to fix, and people seem to be incapable of it. I hate it. I hate the grunts, the slurps, the just everything about it. Like I'm getting annoyed now. Like,
do you know what? Actually, I've picked up again on this is with AirPods in. You know when you're on the phone to someone, it's like you're inside their esophagus. It's like the worst sound ever when someone's like even drinking or eating anything. I think we should ban eating on AirPods. That is something which should not happen.
I mean, I think you should ban eating on like public transport. Or just like it will infuriate me if I'm sat on the train and someone comes next to me and then I see like a sandwich packet open. I'll be like, oh, I'll just have to get off. So, like, because and then I fixate on it. That's all I hear is the munching.
Yeah, not good. Caroline, have you got anything to add to the
Well, the first thing that came to mind, and this will sound really mean, but there's a certain person that when they get to the luggage conveyor belt at an airport, literally loses their mind. They become not an actual normal, reasonable, rational person. And they stand so close to the conveyor belt, they're practically lying on it, and then proceed to pick up every single case of every single colour and shape, thinking that it's theirs. It's like you've lost your actual brain.
Yeah.
You put your bag in a couple of hours ago and you've completely forgotten what it looks like. And it's like this, I find them, I just want to literally punch them. I don't know what it is. It just grates on my nerves so much. But I've got much better with it. I've, you know, had some therapy. I move away from that. There's always one. And you can see they just kind of turn into some...
Do you know what
mad person.
You just made me think of one either. You know, at like when you're at some kind of event or something and there's free food, humans turn into like
animals.
It is the most mental thing. You watch people sort of congregate around a door where something's coming in. It's like, have you never eaten before? Also, like, what is going on?
Or eaten that amount of food on one plate? You don't need all of that. What are you doing?
No one's coming to like a networking event to have a full dinner, are they? It's just a weird... No. People lose the concept of like what normal life is. Yeah, really.
You just been thinking of another one I hate.
I love it.
The tube, if you're stood on the platform and the platform's empty and there's someone comes and just stands right next to you thinking that you suddenly know where the doors are, and I deliberately do it where I know the door isn't, I stand there. When the tube like pulls up, I just walk away so I know where the door is. It's just like you've got the entire platform and they're stood right next to you like sheep. They've just followed you and stopped.
Well, there we go. Thank you both so much. I really enjoyed that, and I think that we need to be having more conversations like this. And I think that, you know, you two are setting a massive example for lots of, you know, women entering the industry and also continuing through in the industry. So thank you very much. And I'll speak to you soon.